This is CliffCentral.com.
I'm very happy to sit opposite Tracy Going and chat to her again. And every time I see your face, it kind of takes me back in time because I think, oh, that's the woman who woke me up in the mornings. And I used to get dressed for school and for varsity.
Oh, no,
no, no, I'm not trying
oh,
to
no,
date.
Oh, no, that sounds terrible.
I'm not trying to date you.
Was it that long ago?
You know what? You just told me 15 years ago. You were on that morning
That's
show.
That's right, right. I think it's
and you just said that you're going back for the first time in 15 years to talk to Leanne Manis on Morning Live.
Yes. I actually have been back before, but it's been a while since I was last in the studio, so I'm looking forward to chatting to her.
Well, it's really nice to see you. I mean, you've got really a very identifiable voice and face, and people all over South Africa know who you are. And you were around at a time where we needed to know what was really going on. You were reliable. You were friendly. You're the kind of person who absolutely made it worth kind of turning on the TV.
Well, thank you, Gareth.
It's worth saying that. Often I meet people who are in the same field as me, and instead of just allowing a little bit of the fan to shine through, which I like to do occasionally, you deserve to feel good about the contribution you made to my life. A lot of people tend to be very professional. So, Tracy, tell us about your book straight away.
Yeah.
But you did. You made a big deal of television in those
Thank
in those
you.
Days.
I loved it. And of course, I was there for the time of transition as well,
yeah,
in the country, which was such
That's
an exciting
I mean.
Time to be there.
You were on when we didn't really have an idea of how much was going on until we heard it from reputable, credible people.
Yeah.
And you'd done radio news for years before that, too.
That's
so
right.
Your voice was already familiar to millions of South Africans.
That's right. That's nice to be back on radio.
Well,
it's
so
it exciting is. To hear you on radio again.
Yeah, it's really good to see you. And I've got to tell you, this book of yours hit me right where it hurts. It's just an incredibly honest and quite difficult thing to read. I can only imagine how difficult it was to decide to write it and then to actually go through the process of writing. It's almost like it's cathartic, I'm sure, but it must have been a little traumatic in some ways.
It was something that I'd known I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to write a book, and I could have written the book many times over the last 18 years since the court case came to an end. But I also had to wait so that I could reach a point of being healed enough to write a book, because if I'd written it 10 years ago, it would have been a completely different story, the way I saw things.
Is that because you're still in the moment and it's still very raw and you need a little bit of gap to give it context, to give it historicity, to be able to look at it in a
absolutely
in a sensible,
I need to be able to step
sober
back.
Way, you know.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I've often, you know, we've all heard stories of people coming out 20 years later, and you think, but why have people taken so long to come out and accuse a rapist or whatever, you know, whatever we've seen around the world at the moment? And I just want to tell you that, I mean, it's been 18 years since my court case ended, and healing is a journey. It is such a long process. So writing the book, I obviously had to go back, and I wrote the book, a lot of it is about the court case, which was so harrowing and really spurred me on. And I mean, I sat with those court records as I wrote this book because I had to be script specific. You know, I did word for word what happened in the courtroom at times in some of the chapters. And just going back there and just going back into that terrible ordeal of the way I was bullied and mocked and humiliated in the courtroom was a terrible place to be. But it took me a year to write the book. Sometimes I had to walk away because I just couldn't come back and write anymore for weeks. I was too upset, too afraid, too angry, whatever emotion it evoked. But it has been very healing overall.
Wow. There's so many places I want to start. I first of all almost feel like people in South Africa owe you an apology. And I'll tell you why, and this may be presumptuous of me, and I hope you'll smack me back down if I am being presumptuous. But here you were, someone who'd built a really successful career in television and radio at a time when there weren't a lot of people who were stars in television and radio. You were you were working really hard. You had you had a career you could be proud of. You had a son. You had a life. And then this man came along and made Tracy Going into, that woman who was abused. He took your whole career and redefined it in a sentence, and suddenly people...
He redefined my entire life.
That's the point. And I feel like the whole country owes you an apology for going along with that. It almost feels to me like it's so unfair for someone who'd put in the amount of work and time and trouble that you had, this professional career, and then that's what you're known for.
And he took it all away with his fists. He took everything. He took away the way I defined myself. He took away my certainty. He took away who I thought I was. Because to be beaten up by somebody, isn't it, is a terrible thing to – and I write even in the book about him kicking me, and that is a terrible thing, to be kicked, to be lying on the ground and somebody is kicking you. So he took away so much from me. But it was also a different time then, because our only way we got the news was through the newspapers or radio or television. You know, now there's social media. Now you have an opportunity to actually maybe speak back. But in the courtroom, you know, in a situation like with what happened in my case was he brought out – a very big, strong defense team. And they were determined to keep their client out of jail. And for them, it becomes a game, really. It's a game of who can be smarter in the courtroom. Well, that was my experience anyway, or the way I feel about it. So although I took a stand and I went to court, I became voiceless in the courtroom. Because they painted a picture, they were trying to paint a picture of me. I mean, they threw anything at me, whatever they could do. It didn't matter if it was true or not true. They accused me of all sorts of things, you know, being neurotic, being a prescription drug addict, a bad mother, you know, volatile. They try to paint this picture of this woman who is a slag. What's the word?
But you didn't recognize any of that in their descriptions.
No, well, I wasn't any of that.
But it still hurt, right?
Well, you're voiceless. You can't. I'm sitting in the courtroom and saying, but I'm not that. I don't take prescription. You know, I'm not a Prozac addict or whatever they accuse me of. So you deny, you deny, you deny. But that's all you're doing is you're offsetting all the time. And that's why I felt voiceless. It was almost as though nobody was listening to me. The magistrate certainly, I didn't feel he was listening to me. He didn't listen to me.
There's so much to go back on before we get to the actual trial, which I do want to spend a lot of time talking about, because it to me is an illustration of just how badly it can go for a victim when they get victimized a second time in the courtroom. Mm. And there are so many South African women who've probably been through this and potentially worse whenever they are in a situation where they feel that the only reprieve, the only kind of justice they can seek is through the courts, and then the courts themselves turn into a place of abuse. So I want to focus on that quite heavily.
And that's the thing, Gareth, is if it can happen to me, and I say that with humility,
right?
You know, I was a television radio presenter at the time. I had a profile. And if that can happen, what is happening to other women who are standing in a queue trying to get a restraining order, who are going to court, who are just fighting for their survival? I mean, I still had a platform. I still had people around me. I had organizations supporting me. I had journalists supporting me. And still, I didn't win the case as such. I mean, he was found guilty, but it wasn't a resound. It was more of a tap over the knuckles.
I just want to find out what kind of a life you had before this guy came into it, and how well it was going for you, because you seem to me to have had a very happy childhood. You seem to have had, well, I mean, at least in respect of your mother and the love you got from her, but not from your dad.
No. I think so.
Well, you're a happy, smiling kid in these pictures.
No,
you know?
I'm a happy, smiling person. I am, and I'm the triumph. So it might not be a redemptive story per se, but.
But your dad was an alcoholic.
My dad was an alcoholic. He was a violent man. So the book is really about growing up in a home of domestic violence and then thinking it'll never happen to me, and then it does happen to me. So it was that total whammy of...
But this is that whole thing they talk about cycles repeating themselves.
Well, that's
but this doesn't mean you asked for it. You weren't the abuser. Usually when they talk about the cycle, they mean someone who's abusive creates a child who's abusive. That wasn't the case with you. You were being abused, and your father had been abusive to your mother.
And as a child, of course, you'd really have little space to, you know, you try and stop the fights, and but you don't really have a voice either. So as an adult, it was important to me to have a voice and to stand up and go to court. And then, of course, it didn't quite play out that way.
So tell me about the kind of life that you had up to this unfortunate relationship, because you... Yeah,
look, I don't think there's certainly a link. I mean, you mentioned the cycle of abuse. I can't say that what happened to me being caught up in an abusive relationship was not related to having grown up in that environment, because I think perhaps your sense of self is a little skewered when you grow up in a home of domestic violence. Right. And also what you think is normal is for other people completely unnormal. So maybe and I hope in the book I've also spoken about warning signs, because there definitely were warning signs there. And I hope that I've explained how I excused them as well and accepted the behavior.
And do you think that some of that was imprinted on you by the relationship between your mother and father?
Absolutely.
I mean, not to say in any way that that means that you're preparing yourself for a life of abuse. No one wants that. But that some of that behavior had a psychological effect on you that you only discovered years later had done damage.
I think it always known it had done damage. But perhaps it was to my advantage as well, because when I first had his hands around my neck choking me, I knew that was wrong. I knew it was wrong, and I got a restraining order immediately. So it wasn't that I hung around, and once the restraining order was in place, he started phoning and apologizing, and then started that whole cycle, you know, sending flowers, I'm so sorry.
I love you, I can change.
I can change, and only you can make me, you know, I need you with me, I can't do this on my own, that type of thing. And then, of course, he beat me up, and I didn't anticipate that. But when he arrived at my house on that day, I just knew it was going to happen. I just knew.
Wow. I wanted to talk a little bit about what had led to this relationship, because you said he slid into your life effortlessly. He kind of spent the one night after you'd had very cool, very friendly, very happy, very memorable moments sitting in the veranda with a glass of wine. It was a very casual relationship.
It wasn't a big love.
And then the one night he was sleeping on the sofa, and then there was a point somewhere where you said to him, look, you've got to move out, because he'd been hanging around.
He sort of just moved in.
And you said arrived without even a suitcase.
Yeah, he did.
And then you needed to get rid of him, and then that's where he suddenly had this fit of rage, this outburst, and it took you by surprise.
Looking back, I only realized that he obviously had nowhere to stay, because he just said to me, oh, you know, it's late and whatever, can I just sleep on the couch? And I was like, yeah, sure, you know, it was very casual. And really, it was just a relationship that happened. I knew him from the film industry. So it wasn't, so I sort of thought, well, I know him. I knew he had a reputation for being aggressive. And then suddenly he was this different person to me. And I thought, oh, you know, I'd accepted this judgment so easily. And, you know, people talk badly about others. And and he's not so bad. And he's really lovely and all of that. But it really didn't take long. It was really a matter of months before it all fell apart. And I saw who he really was. So he did just sort of, you know, say, well, let me just sleep on the couch. Sure, okay. And then 2 months later, it was a case of he'd actually moved in, and I asked him to move out. And he said to me, you're just like my mother. You know, and his mother wasn't a great relationship from what he told me. So suddenly I felt he attacked me as a woman. He attacked me as, I thought, oh, I'm a bad woman. I'm not nurturing.
And you thought, am I like his mother?
Yeah, am I like his mother? That's terrible. I can't be like his mother. How can I hurt him like this? And then eventually you end up saying, I'm so sorry, please stay. So that really is, I mean, that's one of the warning signs, you know, and that's that turning the situation onto the victim. It made me feel guilty, made me feel responsible. And I actually, looking back, I only realized that he actually had nowhere else to stay. So, but the warning signs are there.
But it seems that because women have this nurturing character, and by and large, I'm not talking about every woman, obviously, but the basic predisposition of a woman is to nurture, is to look after, is to take care of, is to try and improve and to try and love and to try to feed. And that was taken advantage of too, because suddenly you became a refuge and a source of sucker.
It's part of the pattern. So, look, this is not an isolated incident. I was not the only one who was beaten up by this man. Sure. So it is the way, and there are a lot of people out there who behave like him. And you'll definitely see that this is part of the pattern where you make the person your victim. It's part of the coercing and manipulating and controlling. So by making you feel guilty that you're not nurturing, you know, the fault then becomes yours. And then you start questioning yourself, and then you start becoming insecure. And then they start isolating you from people around you. So it is all part of a pattern. It ticks all the boxes.
It seems like guilt plays a huge part in all of this. Like your guilt over things you're not even guilty of. And him trying to make you feel guilty about things that you didn't necessarily have a part in.
Well, I felt terrible that he was so hurt that I'd asked him to move out. I felt terribly guilty.
He clearly didn't feel a damn thing. He was very good at making you feel stuff, but he didn't feel anything, right?
That's what you're talking about, Gareth. That's exactly what it was. He makes you feel guilty about things that you haven't even done. And that's part of the manipulation, and that's part of putting a person in a position to be beaten up.
Do you have those moments where you're guilty in a different sense, that you look back on the Tracy going of those days when you started to feel something for him and you think, what a fool I was?
Well, that is a large part of the thing, is because your judgment was so skewered, so you start doubting your ability to judge others. Yeah, to judge others.
Am I a bad judge of character? Do I like the bad boys? And, you know, there's no help from society in all of this. There's no refuge for a woman who's full of those doubts because someone's put them in her head.
Yeah.
In her head. There's no place for that woman to go, because society kind of enforces those ideas and says, oh, well, you know, maybe you're just being a bit loose. Mm. Maybe you like a bit of the bad boy.
Yeah.
Maybe...
Yeah.
You know, you're just the kind of woman who needs a bit of control in your life. They don't help you.
No, they don't. I mean, I did have a lot of support, but you're so busy picking up the pieces of your life, you know, that you're really actually not even thinking about things on that level at the time.
You described, and this is the part of the book that got me really rattled, you described heartfelt after the whole incident had taken place and you were now in the courtroom. And again, you use words beautifully. It's part of what you used to do as a profession, and you still do, clearly, from the book. You describe in such a stark, intimidating way how you felt when you saw him for the first time after that in the courtroom. And even though there were a lot of people there, it was almost like in the movies where they zero in on someone.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all you saw, and you were really, really traumatized by it.
I was, because first of all, I was afraid of him. I mean, and I'm still afraid of him. And I always will be afraid of him, because I only know him as a dangerous man. So, and again, I think that's that whole guilt thing, because they make you feel bad. So even I wanted to know why. I needed to understand, because he took away so much of myself and who I was and who I thought I was and what I thought my life was about. You want to understand, as a woman who's been beaten up, you want to understand, but why? Why did you do this? Why did you do it to me? Why did you do it to us? You know, what we had was good. Why did you take it away? And those are questions that people ask all the time. So even when he walked into the courtroom the first time I saw him after he'd beaten me up, I still wanted to know why. I wanted to know why. I wanted to see that he looked at me and I saw some remorse, but he just ignored me. There was no remorse.
And there was no why.
There will never be a why. He did it because he could.
Is that a satisfactory answer for you?
I have to accept it. I'll never get an apology. He went on to beat up somebody else after me. So,
Jesus.
It's I will never get an answer to that.
That's so frustrating.
Because it's part of the loss.
But it leaves you with so much unattended stuff that isn't even your stuff.
But that's why healing is so long. It's such a process, because you have to work through all of that as well.
All right. Tell me how you've gone about this healing.
I've had to go back and I've had to think about things, and I've had to accept that I'll never get an apology. I'll never get an apology from my father for the way we grew up with his violence, and I'll never get an apology from the one who beat me up. It's never going to happen. And I have to make peace with that. Because we want an apology. If people do something that's horrible to us, we just want them to say sorry, so that we can all move on. But I'm never going to get that. So I have to accept that I'll never get that.
And is part of that also that you must stop hating and that you've just got to let go? Or do you still hate? I mean, I would.
No, I don't think I've ever hated.
Really?
No.
I mean, in that moment where you're like, he's kicking you. You said he's kicking you on the ground, and you look at yourself in the mirror and you think...
Fear and anger. Fear and anger were the two.
Not hatred.
No, not hatred. Because someone who does that is pathetic, isn't it? Aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a bully. People who do that are bullies. Yeah, I feel sorry for him. I wouldn't like to live life like that, beating up people.
Have you ever encountered him since then? Because that would be horrible.
No, I haven't, but I had my book launch last night at Love Books, and somebody in the audience who I didn't know said that they do know that he is around and he's back in the country, because he was out the country. So I haven't seen him. And
I hope you never do.
I hope I never do as well.
I mean, for you, it would be horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I will always be on high alert.
No, but even you mentioned going through the court records and things. That was difficult for you. Mm. So you don't need to be reminded of that by his physical presence.
No.
Which would be no good. I mean, come on, Tracy, can you switch your phone off for me?
Sorry.
You obviously have forgotten about the rules of TV
and broadcasting. My phone's always on silent. Oh, no. Sorry, Gareth. Sorry.
No, that's fine. Oh, this story is instructive. I mentioned to you just a moment ago that the takeaway for me, and I think it's why you said you wrote the book in the first place, wasn't necessarily just for you. It was actually so that some of the people reading this in the criminal justice system can see how hard it is for a victim, first of all, to be brave enough to come forward, and then to go through this very grueling process of having your character assassinated.
And mocked and belittled.
Just so that you can get some kind of restorative justice, which never happened in your case.
No, it didn't. And also when we look around what's happening now, which is, again, I mean, there were many reasons that I was sort of provoked to write the story. I start off my prologue with the Oscar Pistorius trial and how I completely fell apart watching that trial and reliving the court case and seeing the witnesses being belittled. I mean, I speak about Michelle Berger, and she was the neighbor who heard Reva screaming.
Right.
And the way that she was humiliated and dismissed in the courtroom is shameful, shameful. We've seen it with...
And that was on television, so we could all see it.
Yeah, and we've seen the witnesses being pulled apart, the state expert witnesses in the Susan Rhoda murder trial.
Yeah.
You know, and I just don't think it should be allowed. I think there should be a line. In fact, I think is it the judge or the magistrate in the Rhoda trial actually intervened at some point and said this is a witness, not the perpetrator. And I think it should be managed a whole lot better in the courtroom. I think I was cross-examined for 3 days. He was cross-examined for 3 hours. That tells you what's happening in the courtroom alone.
Hmm.
I was there being found guilty or innocent, not him.
And he was the one charged.
Yeah. So, I haven't seen things change.
You mentioned Pistorius and Rhoda, and there was a story just this week about some guy in the southern suburbs in Cape Town whose wife was found in the boot of the car dead.
Rob Packham.
That's right. And I can't, to me, there seems to be something very wrong with men in South Africa. And I'm not saying this is some broad generalization, but it seems that there are some men in this country who have very deep-seated, very dangerous and difficult inabilities to deal with their feelings. Mm. And they take it out on the people they supposedly love. Have you... had paused to kind of step back and with a bit of time and objectivity look at your story, look at these other stories of these women I've just mentioned now, and see any kind of common thread, anything that identifies what that problem might be for those men, and then that obviously becomes a problem to their wives and their lovers and their partners.
We have a very violent history in this country, and that is without a doubt impacted on the way we treat each other. In my book, I speak about living in Brits, and I speak about some of the neighbors that we had, and they were very high profile members of the AWB. Hmm. So I also spoke in the book about the violence. It's almost this underlying current of violence wherever we look. So growing up in Brits all those years ago was this undercurrent of Afrikaner violence, and then I'm having this violence in the home. You know, it's just part of our culture, and this is so in other words, it happens across all sectors of society.
No, you're saying it's not specific to
no
Afrikaans white people.
No,
it's
not
black
at all.
People, it's white people, it's English, it's Afrikaans. Just by the way, I'm fascinated. How the hell did an English girl grow up in Brits? How did that happen? Because Brits is not particularly well known for its English community.
No. We were quite isolated then. Yes, we'd moved from Port Elizabeth to Brits. And I think my father was sort of maybe hoping for a new beginning in his own life, you know, but the alcoholism had already kicked in. And
how bad was it with him?
He was very bad. He was dead by 52.
You said you either saw him drinking in the house or he was at the bar.
Yeah. He deteriorated. I mean, he just couldn't function as a person. I think the last time he held a job was at about 38. So, and then he was dead by 52. He was a really bad alcoholic. There was just nothing left of him. And I talk in the book about how eventually he lived like a drunken ghost in our house. And we ignored him and pretended he didn't exist. And, you know,
it's a horrible thing to say, but were you relieved when he died?
Yeah, I wasn't. I wasn't particularly sad when my father died. I didn't lose a father. I'd never really had a father. I do have happy memories, of course, as a child, you know, younger, but there
that's
was
what I meant when I said earlier that you had this happy childhood. It certainly seemed to me that you had developed some kind of carapace, some sort of a shield against this. You were almost like any kid would in survival mode a lot of the time. Any kid put into that situation would find a way to make it work and would think, well, maybe I'm not that different to other kids. Maybe they also have fathers who are like this.
I mean, you know that your home is not – you don't invite friends to come and sleep over at your house. You can't. You know that things are not right.
But was Brits a nice environment for you? I mean, in terms of – were there friends? Were there things that you could –
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's that wonderful freedom of growing up in a, you know, on a farm, really. Yes. Barefoot and riding motorbikes and swimming in the reservoir, and it was
like in some ways kind of carefree and but your father was obviously this shadow that kind of loomed over everything.
Yeah, and because he could take it all away so quickly, you know, depending on how much he'd had to drink.
But he was abusive to your mother. Was he abusive to you as well, physically?
Not to me. No. My brother took a fair amount of the violence.
Your brother, that's an interesting story in here too. And he died quite young.
He died, he was 20 when he died, yeah.
Yeah, you've got a picture of him in here too.
Yeah.
And, I mean, were you guys really, really close? What was the...
Really close, and it just ripped us all apart as a family when he died. It was just so terribly, terribly sad.
What happened to him?
He had a car accident. But I think he lived recklessly. Hadn't been easy for him. And, yeah, I think he just lived recklessly.
Well, then, out of the family, you're the survivor.
Well, and I've got a brother and sister, and we're okay. You know, we're okay. I think my mother sort of kept it together for us as children.
No, that's very clear, too, from what you wrote.
Yeah.
Do you think that having a strong female role model is kind of helpful in these situations?
Absolutely. You'll see children who pull through have invariably had somebody who's looked out for them. So we're okay. We're okay. It's a story of triumph.
No, I'm not trying to, you know, give you a reason to wallow in self-pity. That's not what the book is about either. Yeah. And I've got to make it clear. I mean, the thing I get out of it is that you're not screaming victim, victim the whole time. You're actually trying to find a way to make it possible for other people who are in a victim situation to break free. It's taken you a long time to realize that none of it was your fault and that none of this was necessarily the kind of thing that anyone would ask for in any lifetime. But it happens, and it happens, and you then have to find a way of making through
and
it.
And terrible things happen to people all the time.
Sure.
And, I think a lot has to do with the way we cope with it, you know. And, things happen. And we've got to get up and we've got to face the next day and put a smile on your face and things will be okay.
What would have been a better outcome for you in terms of the court case? I mean, would you have liked it if the magistrate had paid attention and actually...
Well, I would have liked to have been heard in the courtroom.
You didn't even feel heard?
No, I didn't feel heard at all. No. And it's interesting because what did I really want? Did I want him to go to jail? I mean, I can't imagine the enormity of thinking, there again are the guilt, because I would feel guilty that I had
you
put him
sent
in jail.
Him to jail, but yeah. It wouldn't have been you.
So I don't really know. I just felt that he walked away. It was almost pointless going to court. So I didn't really want him to go to jail, but I just think it would have been helpful if he'd apologized, if he'd just been accountable for his behavior. He was never made accountable for his behavior, and I think that's important. Well,
clearly, how did you feel when you found out that he hit another woman after you? How did you find out about that?
Because people are going to tell you that. And the other, and then of course, right at the end of my court case, because I knew of a previous girlfriend who wouldn't come forward and testify, and that was okay. I understood why.
I think the same happened in the Reva trial.
Yeah, yeah.
There were people who didn't want to talk because they were so afraid.
And because it's made into such a shameful thing. It's such a sordid matter. Nobody wants to be tarnished with that.
Because that's what you become known for.
Mm-hmm. But then, of course, right after the trial, an ex-girlfriend came forward, and he had beaten her up many, many years before. So that just tells you how long it's been all been going on for. And that was amazing, because that was almost, she vindicated me. You know, suddenly it became no longer just he said, she said.
Right.
And when I had my launch in Cape Town last week, she was there, and it was actually incredible.
So when you hear about things like this Me Too movement in Hollywood now, do you feel that this kind of solidarity is empowering, and that it gives people a feeling of combined collective courage, that you can stand up to these horrible men who perpetuate this sort of violence and keep getting away with it?
I think what is exciting about the Me Too campaign is that it seems as though there's been a shift in attitude. You know, men have lost their jobs. We're going to see that abusive men are not going to – they feel entitled. They feel that they're allowed to behave like this. They can take from you what they want. And I think suddenly some people are saying, oh, the Me Too campaign, you know, women are speaking out. It's not that women are speaking out. They've been speaking out all along. It's just that now we're being heard, and that is an interesting and exciting shift. I'm not speaking out now. I spoke out when this happened.
Yeah.
But now I'm being heard. I wasn't then.
That's quite gratifying. You mentioned, in a very personal sense, obviously, it's not the kind of thing that gives you joy in a public way, but it must make you feel, okay, we're making some progress here. Because you did go through a lot of pain on your own.
Yeah, I think we need to see a lot more progress, though. And I'm not sure. We're not seeing it yet. We're not seeing it in the courtroom.
No.
We just don't have that sense of enlightenment, I don't think. And I don't know how we create that.
I want to ask you something tough. Being on television, it has a lot to do with your looks.
Okay. Oh, my gosh, Gareth, what are you going to say to me?
No, I'm not going to be inappropriate.
Because years ago, somebody said to me, you'll never make it because you're too much like the girl next door.
No, I mean, I think you were always a very pretty girl. You were always very attractive on television. That's absolutely not the point I was going to make, but that you need to look a certain way on television, and you tick those boxes too. So when you were beaten up, did you in that moment think, oh, my God, I can't go on TV now?
Well, I couldn't go on TV.
No, but was that one of the first things you thought? Because that would be,
No. I've never operated from that sense of vanity.
I'm not saying vanity. This is like your income. This is your livelihood. People are going to say, you can't just put makeup on for this. I mean, we've seen the pictures of you.
You see, now, as he beat me up, he said to me, you need your effing face. And he went straight for my face. And it was very interesting, because very often women do not show the bruises because they're beaten from the neck down. So, but he targeted my face deliberately, saying, you need your face. And I did need my face. I couldn't go on camera it was really 6 weeks that I couldn't go on camera because my eye was swollen closed for weeks, or bruised and battered and leaking and all sorts of terrible things. I went back to radio after 2 weeks, and it was really only 6 weeks later. I couldn't work. So it wasn't even a vanity thing. I actually couldn't go in front of the camera.
And who did you tell first at work? I mean, how does that even work? Because it must be awful to contemplate the fact that you've got a certain amount of time, and you have to like check in at work and say, listen, I'm not going to be able to come in, and they're going to say, why? And were you honest with them straight away? What did you say?
Well, I was, because I was working on Radio Metro then with Bob Mabena in the mornings. And Bob and I have always been, you know, we'd always been close and whatever. So it was easy to, you know, I could make the call.
You called
the
him?
The call, yeah, I phoned the radio. I think I can't remember really. I know, but Bob would have been one of the, you know, would have been one of the first people. My big concern, and I had a new client that I was doing a corporate video with on the Monday, and he beat me up, you know, on the Saturday. So that was a terrible call to make, to let the client down. But the worst was to phone my ex-husband, and he had my son with him for the weekend, thank heavens. And that was a terrible call to make, to phone him and say, listen, please, this is what's happened.
Keep him with you.
Just keep him with you for a little bit longer.
And you couldn't keep him away for 6 weeks.
No, no. In fact, what I needed to do was I needed to actually clean up the house.
Yeah, because he destroyed the house. Yeah. He destroyed the garage.
And I didn't want my son coming home to that. I mean, it was a mess. It was a mess. He'd trashed the furniture. And so I needed to clean all of that up. And then only could my son come home once the house looked supposedly normal.
And did he ask mommy what happened?
He wanted the details. He wanted to know, how did he hit you? Did he hit you like this? Did he hit you like that? What happened first? Did he take the table first or did he hit you first? He needed to know things like that. So I had to keep it simple.
How old was he at the time?
He was 6.
Oh, my God.
It's a terrible thing because it's not what you want for your child.
But your child looks up to you. You're a pillar of strength to him. You're the person who's most influential in his life. And then he has to hear this. It must be.
He has to see it. And if I can't keep myself safe as a mother, how can he trust me?
My God, that's hard. Where do you begin to wrestle that crocodile?
Yeah.
Where do you start? I mean, did you say
to
him?
I had to get him into therapy immediately.
Right.
That was my priority. He was my priority because as a child, I had certainly never thought it would happen to me. I mean, I made a decision as a child that this would never happen to me. And then it did. And then, of course, I brought it into my child's life, which I never. I mean, it was, how could I possibly do that?
Yeah, but again, this is you being guilty.
Well, it's being real as well.
No, but this is
because he saw me
at
them.
Of course, but at that time, you're like, how could I bring this into my child's life? But yeah. It's not. You didn't bring it in.
Well,
invite this. You didn't open the door and say, "Come on in here and let's screw up my whole life."
But my son will never unsee that. He saw me beaten up, broken.
Are you relieved though that he wasn't there when it happened? Because that would have been so much more traumatic for him. And he might have intervened, and who knows what could have happened.
Yeah.
Because you know as a child when this happens.
I know what it is to stand at the door and watch.
Oh.
And I didn't want that for my child.
Did he ever bring it up as a problem later on in life? Did he ever say to you, this is something that's still hovering
over
me?
Because it was so public, Gareth, it was not the biggest kept secret in the family, you know, because very often domestic violence, you know, nobody talks about it in the home.
What's your feeling on that before we hear about your son? Do you think that's a good thing that people keep it secret? Or do you think that people should be encouraged to be open about it? Because
well, that's
it's a
where
reality.
The shame comes from, doesn't
right.
it? You keep it as a secret.
But it happens, whether they say that one in every three women in South Africa or something. So then how can it still be shameful? It should be shameful to those men. It shouldn't be shameful for a woman to admit this. What do you think of that?
When I was writing the book, I started off by writing about things like when I was beaten up. Then I read a very interesting article about the way we talk about violence and abuse and rape and whatever, and we talk about when I was raped. Now, when you say when I was raped or when I was beaten up, there's no perpetrator in that sentence.
So when he raped me.
Yeah.
When he
so
beat
I
me up.
I very actively went in and spoke about when he beat me, because we need to change the way we talk about it. How can we talk about abuse and rape without mentioning the perpetrator? So the moment we can transfer, you know, start putting the shame really where it lies. So I did. I went back and I made sure that I'd written after he beat me. Or when he beat me.
It's a big mind shift, actually.
It's a big mind shift.
And maybe that's at the heart of why the courts treat the victim as the perpetrator and the other way around with the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because our language doesn't help us in this respect. That's a big discovery.
Yeah.
All right, so you're back to your son. So the shame, and it leaks out, you know, kind of some members of the family are talking and other people obviously are talking.
Yeah, so we had to, and of course he was seeing the, you know, newspapers, children at school were talking about it.
Sure.
So we couldn't avoid it. And I think that was a good thing. looking back, of course, sure. At the time it was horrendous because I didn't want him to have it in, be aware of it all the time. And then the court case went on for 2.5 years. So it wasn't something that he could walk away from either.
He never had a pause afterwards to say to you.
He still can't talk about it.
Really?
No. And he's 26 now. So, So it'll always be between us.
It's bloody hard to deal with.
But you know what's been interesting, Gareth? Because of social media, we can access, you know, we can access anybody. I have messages from all over the country, from men mostly. It's been quite profound as to how men have responded to this. I have men, last night, even at the launch, I had someone come up to me and just apologize, you know, feeling terrible as a man. It's been so interesting because I thought this is going to be just about women, but it's not.
Mm. Well, it's obviously not because the perpetrators are never women.
Yeah.
You know, you may hear about the very odd, very strange occasion where there's a woman who retaliates or that...
Well, just look in the media at the moment. You mentioned Susan Rhodes, Jill Packham, Karabo Mokoena.
Yes.
It's just relentless.
Even Hope Zinde's son, you know, that whole story. God,
that is a terrible story and nobody wins.
Now, there's a very... painful part of the book where you talk about how people, you would walk out in public, even years after this, and people would sort of, and this happens to anyone who's well known, it's happened to me from time to time, where people will say, oh, there's that guy from the TV. Mm-hmm. But you knew that they were saying, there's that woman who got beaten up. Did that hurt you in kind of some deep, unpleasant,
I think the one of the biggest shocks
continually painful way?
Was seeing my photograph, the photograph of me. After he beat me up.
Yeah.
Seeing that in the media, that was, I tried to stop that. But once the photograph.
How did it get out?
It's, once it enters the court system, it becomes public. Oh, it's right. Public property
of course,
then.
Of course.
So I had to almost remove myself. I had to pretend it wasn't me. I just, and I'm now immune to that photograph. Gareth, you were asking me.
So when people would whisper and carry on.
You have to put a shield on. You just have to pretend that it's, you sit in the courtroom, you pretend the allegations, it's not you they're talking about. When people put their hand over their eye, because they'd say, oh, that's, well, remember the one with the eye? And I'd see, and then you just have to sort of turn the other way and pretend it's not you. And even writing the book, even though I've written in the first person, and it's very definitely me I'm talking about, I felt even writing it, I had to pretend that it wasn't really me, because some of it is still so shameful.
And this guy would do things like phone you before the court case commenced and threaten you.
Yeah, he threatened.
He kept the fear going.
Oh, yes.
All the way through.
Yeah. And he told me, he said, I will kill you. I put a hit on you. And I believed him.
So then you... Everything terrifies you. You hear a noise at night. You can't sleep.
Well, during for the
your son is
court
with you.
Case was 2.5 years, but really for the first 2 years, I was very seldom alone. I always had somebody sleeping in my house, or my doors locked, and a weapon under my pillow, my dog inside. Trying to stay safe. I hardly moved out of my home. I'd go to work and I'd come home, because I was too afraid of him out there.
And the other part about this that's very revealing and must have been difficult to write about was the depression.
Yeah.
Because that kicks in a very real and profound way too. And
halfway through the trial, he ran away. He skipped the country. And that
which
was
should
terrible.
Have, which should have made any magistrate go, oh, okay, there may be a problem here. You would think.
Well, he was rearrested a year later and he came before the court and the magistrate said, I believe this man should be given another chance. And he was released on bail immediately. And it was just such a slap in the face for me. But that was, then I knew that this was all pointless.
But you had to carry on. You were in it already.
Yeah, no.
How did you feel on the day that the verdict was given?
I anticipated the verdict, but hearing it was still a shock, because the magistrate found that it was an isolated incident through provocation, and he accused me of using the media, because it was covered in the media, he accused me of manipulating the media, and he said that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. I mean, it was shameful. It was just such a cliche. It really was quite disappointing. And we were completely outraged, but there was nothing we could do.
But you had a lot of support. There were a lot of women who were there to kind of see you when you came out of the courtroom. And you obviously had many people in the media fraternity who were saying to you, you know, yeah, we're here to back yeah. you up. And
but I had to take the media on at some point as well, because yeah. Because some of it, really, and nothing has changed, Gareth. You know, headlines like Lover's Fury Retold. Those are terrible words. They made me sound common. And it was not about that. It's about the power play of a controlling man who is abusive and who enjoys beating up women. I mean, I saw the anticipation in his eyes.
Couldn't wait.
Beat me up. Yeah, yeah.
How do you know when it's coming to an end? Like, how do you, if you're in that moment, how do you know it's going to stop now? Because that's probably what you're waiting for while
it's happening.
That
he's going to stop hitting you.
Yes. How does that?
Well, the only reason he stopped with me was because my neighbors broke my door down to get me out. So that was the only reason it came to an end.
Good God. You mean he probably would have carried on? He might have killed you.
He might have killed me. I thought I was going to die.
And the physical pain's nothing compared to the feeling.
No.
The feelings inside, like the way it makes you feel.
I can't, there are no words to tell you how you feel.
You know, you're so controlled, you're proud, and you should be proud of you, but there must have been so many cracks that you kept hidden. Must have been so many times you cried in the shower.
Well, you have to keep it together. I had a son, I had to keep it together, I had to go to work. I was a freelancer, so I wasn't working. If I wasn't working, I wasn't earning. And when something like this happens, I mean, I had to move house to get away from him. I had to get rid of my car. I had to put up burglar bars, bring in all sorts of security. And then, of course, there were the lawyer's fees. So suddenly all of this has happened, and I've got psychologist's fees for my son, and I've lost my income. Nobody will work with me.
Did that happen? No one will work with you?
Yeah.
Explain that to us.
I was busy negotiating with the SABC at the time to read the 8 o'clock evening news when they still had lots of viewers. And
you can say that.
Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, you were there when they had an audience.
They used to have millions of people watching
that. It was a big deal. The evening news was the most watched television program in South Africa,
that's
right?
That's it, yeah.
So you were in the running to take that
That's right. I was going to take over from Jane Hicks. And yeah, so that was exciting, but then I never got the call to come in and sign the contract.
And do you think that had to do with what was going on in your private life?
Absolutely. I walked past the news editor a year later in the passage at the SABC, and he said to me, "I'm so sorry, I didn't return your calls, but we couldn't touch you." But I knew that.
Do you say anything?
Well, let's face it, as an employer, what do you do?
Yeah.
I mean, here's a sordid court case. The allegations. His defense immediately was that I had lunged at him with a knife and he had put up his arm to protect himself and his elbow had accidentally hit my eye. That was his story.
You're joking.
Yeah. And so now imagine you're an employer and you're hearing, I mean, do you really want a knife wielding person, allegedly, reading your news? You don't. So, you know, I mean, I see their side completely. And it was really only once he sort of skipped the country that then was really the proof that this was not so kosher. And then things changed, and then people started working with me again.
Yeah, and I mean, you certainly, you have a very good reputation in the business. Did it ever worry you that was being...
sullied?
Yeah.
Of course. That was my life.
Did you go around trying to repair it for a couple of years? In other words, it almost with purpose going in to sweep aside that story, that there was more to you than that. You kind of felt that you had to keep on.
No, I didn't do that. Because I knew that I hadn't done it. I have quite a strong center of self.
Hell yes.
I do, you know,
telling me.
I mean, he skips the country and I take on Interpol. I insist that they put him on the database and find him. You know, I didn't... as a child, I tried to stop my father from hitting my mother. You know, I'm not someone generally who just sort of wilts in the corner. I think he picked on the wrong person. Although he made me voiceless and he took away who I really was for a very long time, I think I was always going to bounce back. So I never felt the need to try and explain myself to anybody. I just at times had to pretend it wasn't me and just carry on living my life the way I am.
You don't, like any sensible human being, you don't like violence. You tried to kind of keep your son away from it as much as possible. And
I never even allowed him a toy gun.
Right.
He was never allowed to have it.
Right. I mean, you'd seen enough in your life of that kind of thing to know that it wasn't something you wanted to have him grow up with. But you can't shield people from what the real world's like forever.
Yeah, but that's a terrible thing to bring that into your home.
Well, again, you didn't bring it in.
Oh.
Do you still have sleepless nights now?
I think I worked through a lot of it. But look, he will always be a part of my nightmares. I mean, that's just never going to go away.
And did this whole thing make it very difficult for you to have any kind of relationships afterwards?
Yes. Actually, it was quite funny because I met my husband soon after the court case came to an end.
Yeah.
So that was sort of 2.5 years later.
So it was quite soon after.
It was quite soon after, but I mean, he really had to work hard. Because a friend of mine actually worked for him, and she said, "Oh no, I want to introduce you to my boss." And I was like, "Oh no, I just wouldn't hear the word man."
Yeah.
And then sort of.
Because it's also hard. There are a lot of women not necessarily comfortable talking about this, but you do kind of dislike men for a while. All men.
Well,
you can't help it. There's a male energy that's.
No, because that male energy is not across the board. It's not across the board. So it's never that I disliked men. I just know.
You certainly don't trust all of them.
You know, I didn't trust all of them. But not all men are like that. No, they're not. They are not.
But you can understand how some people would be traumatized enough to want to say that it's all men because it gives them a category to avoid.
Yeah, no, it's not all men. And it's not unfair to label all men that way. No, so I didn't distrust men. I trusted my sense of judgment.
Okay, well, that's important because you said earlier, and I think I can understand and agree with the point of view that you did at some point wonder about your judgment.
Yeah, a lot of the time, for a very long time.
Absolutely, and any woman in this situation would have to have a moment to reflect and go, what am I not seeing or seeing, even though that's not their fault?
I didn't just write the book either. You know, it's not sort of just words. I actually did quite a bit of research as well so that I could try and show some insight. So maybe somebody reading the book would think, but hang on, the same is happening to me. You know, suddenly, you know, I'm not allowed to phone my family or go out for Sunday lunches or meet with my friends on Thursday nights or whatever it is. So I've tried to really put the red flags in some of the red flags that I ignored. And I'm hoping that maybe if someone reads the book and they think, okay, this is not right. This is not right. Let me get out of this. I'm hoping.
But you did, you met this husband of yours to go back to relationships. And was this the kind of relationship that you'd really hoped for?
Yes, it was a very gradual relationship as well. And then I ended up marrying him. We've been together now for all these years.
What did he think of the book?
He will never read the book. He's not a reader.
He won't read it?
No, he will never read the book.
Did you run anything by him? You're like, what do you think of this?
No, not really. I think I read him one chapter. But I'm okay with that. I don't need him to. In fact, I actually don't want him to read the book.
Really?
He doesn't need to know all of that.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't need to know all of that.
You guys must talk, though. And he knows this is part of your story. It's not your life, but it's a part of your life.
Yeah, but we don't talk about the details or whatever. And it's not something that I focus on either. I mean, I had to go back and remember because the book, but it's not something that I carry with me all the time. I've had to work through a lot of it. But actually, I'm very happy that he doesn't know all the details.
That really, forgive me if I'm being like too prurient here, but... Like, it does strike me as strange that he's not going to read your book.
No, he's not going to read my book.
His wife's book.
And I don't expect him to, so I won't be disappointed.
Okay. All right. And you say your son doesn't talk about it either, which is interesting. I almost feel like you get to share this awful but very, very triumphant story with all of us, but not with the two men closest to you.
Yeah.
Strange,
my son,
right?
I mean, I think my son will read it one day, but he won't read it yet. He would read it. My 13-year-old little boy started reading it, because he's the only of my children that'll really read.
Yeah.
He started reading it, and he said, "Mama, gee, this is more well written, Mom." I said, "Thanks, my boy." And then he got to sort of the second chapter, and he said, "Mom, I don't think I'm ready to read this." And I said, "It's okay. You don't have to."
What a mature child.
Yeah.
Decide that's not for me now.
Yeah.
That takes some gumption. Well, listen.
That's quite sweet.
I think that this is probably a little overdue, because there are so many people who were moved by, frustrated by what you went through. I think you're right about the timing. You do need to gain a little bit of distance in order to have the idea of context. But also, things are changing. And as much as you rightly point out, they're changing too slowly, at least they're changing.
They are. They definitely are.
If there's someone who is listening to us now, hasn't read the book yet, I would strongly encourage you to read it. It's Tracy Goings' book, Brutal Legacy, a memoir. It's not one of those horror stories that doesn't have useful, powerful, meaningful stuff in it. It's not also just
a story.
I did
laugh at times as well.
Well, there are things in here that made me laugh. I almost felt a little bit guilty about laughing at some of them, because you... Again, you have a very interesting ability to make yourself an object in a story rather than to personalize every detail of it. But I wonder what you would say to yourself if you could go back 18 years ago and kind of draw it all again.
Well, look, I mean, I wish he hadn't been a part of my life. But maybe I was meant to write the book.
Nothing's wasted, right?
No, maybe it was just meant to be.
Sure. Well, I'm sorry it had to be you.
It's okay. I'm okay. Yeah, I've worked through a lot. It was quite funny, Gareth, because at very strange times in a book, I would have a meltdown. So it would be like I wrote about when my neighbors broke the door down, and as I wrote the sentence, then I was safe. And then I couldn't go back and write for 2 weeks. And then I had to work through all those feelings of safety or not feeling safe. So it's been quite an incredible process. And I now understand why people write journals. Look, I'm not going to do it. That was an awful lot of hard work. I've never worked so hard in my life before.
Right?
It was hard. You've written a book. It's hard work. And eventually you start counting words, because a book has got to have so many words. But it's been quite a process.
This is hard, though. It's so personal. I think, you know, with every intention of not sounding patronizing, it's brave and courageous. And I hope you don't think that that's me trying to be nice, because that's not my intention.
Well, I think it's quite nice when you're nice, Gary. Thank you.
I'm nice to people who are nice. You're a nice person. You're a terrific person. You shouldn't have had to go through this shit. And neither should your family. But it is what it is. And maybe the rest of us can learn from it.
Thank you.
I hope South African men will read this book. I really do.
And thank you for reading it. And thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it was tough, but it was worth every second. So thank you. And it's always a delight to see you. And I hope that we'll hear and see more of you going forward, because there's too much good to be wasted in a world where there are so few people with media experience and the ability to pull an audience. So we need you back.
Thank you. Thank you, Gareth.
Cool. Tracy Goings, everybody. The book's called A Brutal Legacy, a memoir, and I encourage you to read it. Men, women, children, everybody should read this thing. It's a real life story, and it has real life consequences for so many people in this country. For God knows what reason, it's a mystifying and terrifying thing, but we can begin to understand it through the individual stories of brave women who are willing to tell and who are willing to stand up for themselves and for other women. And that's what Tracy's done. It's great.
This is CliffCentral.com.